humanitarian move was announced during a press conference attended by representatives of Christian and Jewish communities in Iran's parliament.
I should thank the besieged force for this benevolent act, where it factored out the issue of faith and focused on humanity in its charity affairs. The Armenian community has always considered Iran a home, and this will definitely make the recipients of charities happier.
Philanthropy has been a common feature of Iranians since the ancient past. U.S. Jews have been living peacefully in Iran since 2,700 years ago. Today, we witness this friendship and brotherhood in this act of benefaction.
The aid includes staple food and other basic needs, along with cash handouts that cover an average family's monthly spending. The message force says the charity move comes as many families are suffering under growing economic pressure, stemming from inflation and exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic.
We hope that the unwelcome virus will soon be eliminated, but for now, we cannot ignore the fact that many people have lost a significant portion of their income due to the pandemic, and it's upon us to extend a hand of help to them, no matter what religion they practice and what color their skin is.
Iran is a predominantly Muslim country, but it's also home to followers of other religions, such as Jews, Christians, and Zoroastrians. Organizers here say, regardless of their religious beliefs, these minorities are Iranians. They believe such humanitarian events strengthen national bonds and foster peaceful coexistence.
Organizers say humanitarian efforts transcend faith and ethnicity. This is especially the case during the pandemic, which has gripped all people, many of whom have lost their income and now depend on such donations to make ends meet. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Revocation of autonomous status, unprecedented security clampdown, then the COVID pandemic. Last 17 months have been full of darkness and uncertainty in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The months-long lockdown has left the region's economy shattered. According to official statistics, the economy suffered losses of over $5 billion. Tourism industry, which is considered the mainstay of Kashmir's economy, has been one of the worst sufferers. Now, following months of lull, Kashmir's tourist hubs are coming back to life. Winter snow has brought tourists back to the picturesque Himalayan region and raised hope among those associated with the tourism industry. The world-famous ski resort Gulmarg is abuzz with tourists these days.
The losses are humongous, and as far as expectation is concerned, Kashmir tourism is all about hope and expectations. I mean, for the last 20-25 years, entire world knows that we have been running tourism in very, very challenging situations.
Tourism industry, particularly hoteliers in Kashmir, suffer huge losses, first due to scrapping of Article 370 and then due to global pandemic. New Year has brought glamour of hope with tourists returning to Kashmir.
Yeah, this is the first time I'm here. I'm very happy from the core of my heart. I always feel like I'm on the ninth cloud.
The tourism department is organizing various events in a bid to attract more tourists in order to revive the industry. After Winter Games, Gulmarg is now hosting snow sculpting competition. Braving sub-zero temperature, the participants are working with great passion to produce some of the finest works of art. Meanwhile, a 31-member Indian parliamentary delegation is also here to promote tourism. The visiting delegation also met various stakeholders of the region's tourism sector. Situated at an altitude of 2,730 meters above sea level, Gulmarg boasts of one of the highest cable cars in the world. With breathtaking slopes, Gulmarg is one of the finest ski destinations in the world and the heartland of winter sports in India.
Wrapped in a thick carpet of snow, the ski resort of Gulmarg presents a delightful picture these days. It offers best slopes for skiers and attracts sports and adventure lovers from across the world, and also raises hopes for tourism revival in Kashmir. Sidri Safi from Gulmarg Ski Resort in Indian-administered Kashmir.
The 25th edition of Iran's oil, gas, refining and petrochemical exhibition is held in Tehran. Many Iranian companies that are active in oil and gas industry couldn't show their latest products and achievements. Several senior officials from the country's oil industry also attended the opening ceremony of the show. This year, the exhibition was held under the slogan of National Oil, Iranian Goods and Services with a focus on domestic production.
We are a leading provider of infrastructure, technology and construction services in Iran. We specialize in engineering, procurement and construction of LPG storage tanks, and we have completed several projects in South Pars region and Kharg and Siri Islands.
The three-day exhibition covered a range of oil-related fields, including upstream industries, startups, petrochemicals and related industries, gas industry, pipes and tubes, and refining and distribution.
Our company is an engineering and manufacturing company, active in field of gas turbines, steam turbines, and centrifugal compressors. We typically work on a package of industrial line of a gas turbine and steam turbine and a package of a compressor. We typically do manufacturing and design of components and parts, and also provide services for overhaul and maintenance of these equipments only in oil and gas industries.
We produce facilities for gas stations, including dispensers and underground tanks. All our productions are indigenous, and we export them to several regional countries. We also build mobile dispensers and rapid installed stations.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's oil show is one of the major oil and gas events in the world in terms of the number of participants.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, this year's oil show is not open to the public, and only managers, businessmen, and experts are allowed to visit the exhibition. Human Abadi, Tehran.
The number of people sleeping on the streets at night across the European Union is growing by the day amid the pandemic. Welfare systems are under enormous strain. We have been speaking to one homeless man in Brussels who is finding it difficult to acquire emergency accommodation.
It's very hard in the cold, in the winter. It's very hard to feel good, to find somewhere. It's very difficult.
A debate on the worsening social crisis in the EU resulting from COVID-19 has been held in the European Parliament.
We have a problem here. The slow, sluggish bureaucracy of the European Union is not compatible with emergencies like the one we face today.
Governments in the EU are being urged to submit pandemic recovery plans to the European Commission so that €750 billion in available funding can be released without any further delay.
Millions of people lost already their jobs, and they are mainly the low-skilled, the low-paid workers, the temporary workers, the young on precarious work.
The European Parliament debate was told the EU social crisis could last for many years unless action is taken to save economies.
Thousands of businesses have temporarily or permanently closed. Millions of Europeans have lost their jobs and livelihoods.
Many EU legislators say the 27-country bloc's vaccination programme is being delivered too slowly. To make matters worse, experts in the UK are suggesting the new variant of COVID-19, discovered last year in England, might be more deadly than previously thought. EU officials are concerned new variants of the disease might be resistant to approved vaccines and vaccines awaiting approval. With that comes obvious health concerns, but also incredible economic uncertainty. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics is that has found that large swaths of mostly young and highly educated Italians have continued to move abroad in search of working opportunities. Italy's young workers have been living for decades. However, the report has highlighted that over 300,000 Italians aged 18 to 39 emigrated to neighboring European countries and overseas between 2015 and 2019, up 33% compared to 2014. One in three of them were graduates.
These figures show that young Italians, particularly from the rich north, choose to leave the country because the labor market doesn't offer them any prospects. This is why young people from the depressed Italy south continue to emigrate to northern cities. We are calling on the government to invest more in the youth, in its recovery and resilience plan, the investment project using European Union funds to counter the effect of the pandemic.
Youth unemployment level in Italy stands at about 40%. Furthermore, 3 out of 10 Italians between 18 and 24 years of age are not in employment, education or training, the third highest percentage among OECD countries.
A recent study by the European Commission has found that Italy, along with Poland and Romania, is among the European countries that send the most workers abroad. This brain drain costs Italy an estimated 14 billion euros every year.
It's an inconceivable waste. Once trained through our school system, our young Italians offer their skills to foreign countries. It's true, our labor market is stagnant, but it must be said that quite often the system does not reward merit.
Successive Italian governments had long tried attracting back talented workers with tax breaks, with no success. However, a counter-exodus of the brain drain seems to be underway since the start of the pandemic. Data from Italy's foreign ministry shows that in 2020, the number of young Italians returning home increased about 20% over the previous year. Max Civili, Rome.
A London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission made a plea with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, reminding the illegal grounds on which top cleric Sheikh Zazaki and his wife were being kept in prison. Simultaneously, the Islamic Human Rights Commission has also written to the United Nations asking the international body to exert pressure on Nigeria to do the same. Lawyer to the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, expressed shock that 7 days after testing positive to COVID-19, Zazaki's wife, Zinat, is yet to be hospitalized. Also in a press conference, the Islamic movement in Nigeria said that keeping Malama Zinat in Kaduna prison without hospitalization has violated the known guidelines and protocols for the prevention of the spread of COVID-19.
The task force for the COVID-19 pandemic, they went around, even sharing, distributing contacts, that whenever you see somebody affected, you should call them. They will come and immediately evacuate such a person for treatment. But that of Mala Mazina, she's there for 7 days. Till today, she's still in the prison custody.
In December 2015, security forces attacked Zazaki's house and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters and 3 of his biological children. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said it will continue to demand justice for Sheikh Zazaki and his wife.
We call on the masses to join us in calling for justice. We call on the relevant authorities to respect the law of the land and immediately and unconditionally release the couples, as court has ordered for their immediate release.
Zazaki's son, Muhammad, said up to now, his mother, Zinat, is still in Kaduna prison and is yet to be hospitalized. The Islamic movement in Nigeria and Zazaki's son are both calling on the authorities to ensure that she receives proper medical care and to release Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife with immediate effect. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Travel agents in 13 different countries should get ready for a rush of customers. The United States has finally lifted its shockingly xenophobic and unprecedented travel ban. Iran was one of 6 other Muslim-majority nations which were primarily targeted, which caused ex-President Donald Trump's executive order to become called the Muslim travel ban, informally and infamously. New President Joe Biden ended the ban on his first day in office. The bigotry lasted 4 years, and the damage to American citizens, countless non-Americans, and America's image cannot be overestimated.
The real shame in this is not simply turning our back on, America's tradition of not judging people on the basis of their religion or our constitutional prohibition against that. But what's really, troubling about this is that we have gone through this process where family members have not been able to be together with loved ones.
Husbands and wives have been kept apart for years. Grandparents passed away without seeing their newborn grandchildren. Weddings, graduations, birthdays, funerals, jobs, business deals, educational exchanges. The accumulation of grief and difficulty caused by the Islamophobic ban is appalling. In many ways, the ban backfired because it emphatically demonstrated the scope and reach of state-sponsored Islamophobia, something which had been routinely denied by the right and the left, not only in the United States, but across the West.
It's really going to require that we go through the hard work of actually implementing policies, not just in travel, but in other ways that fight against Islamophobia, because we know that it has been a feature in our society, certainly for the last 30 years, but even long before that.
The ban led to doctor shortages in a United States which would soon be unable to handle the coronavirus pandemic. It also put a pause on the so-called brain drain, which allows America to stay near the forefront of science and technology. Trump's dehumanizing of Muslims followed years of scapegoating in order to rationalize the wars across the Muslim world started by Trump's predecessors, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Perhaps above all, the ban showed that in the American system, it is still possible to codify racism into law. The Supreme Court reversed a series of lower court decisions which allowed the ban to go into effect. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kabit Afwai. Scotland has called for another independence referendum. Meanwhile, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said that he will be visiting Scotland soon to see if he can have this separatism rejected. The question is, with the UK itself suffering from an economic downturn, COVID-19 and Brexit, can it make its case? Meanwhile, the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said that the UK may become a failed state. First, let's get more on this story from Rob Carter, who's our correspondent joining us from London. Rob Carter, obviously, we have on the one hand the Scotland's independence bid to come into the picture again. Of course, then what the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said. If you can forge those into one quick response, please.
Sure. Well, obviously, Gordon Brown has issued a stark warning here. The reasons behind his warning are essentially, bottom line, that many people across the UK just simply do not trust Westminster. They do not believe that politicians are competent enough to run things, and there seems to be a huge identity crisis growing across the kingdom. Obviously, as you've mentioned, there are independence movements springing up, and they seem to have increasing amounts of success, particularly in Scotland and Wales, but also in the north of Ireland. Unification push is at an all-time popular height, according to polls, but also the economic damage caused by Brexit and the COVID pandemic. With all of these things, spiraling out of control, it seems, many years in the future, we could see a very disunited kingdom if the United Kingdom actually exists at all. So a stark warning from the former Prime Minister, which may seem a bit over the top for the time being, but when people's livelihoods are struggling and they lose hope financially, which, as we've seen, is happening now, then, of course, things could look very different in the future, possibly lead to some kind of dissent. But the future of the UK could be the next big crises that this kingdom faces in the very near future.
Thank you for that, Rob Carter. We appreciate it. Let me bring in author and commentator John White, who joins us from Edinburgh. John White, welcome. We're looking at the referendum call again from Scotland, the first minister to call it. Tell us about the significance of this timing, if you can, and what that spells for the UK at this point in time. Okay, Derek Conway, who joins us from London. He's a former MP and presenter. Derek, let me address this question to you then.
I think the United Kingdom is far stronger if the nations that make it up stick together. But I think we have to face the fact that the younger generation want their politicians to be more accountable. Really doesn't matter which country you're in. And they want decision-making to be nearer to them. So if you're a young person living in Scotland, Westminster and its raging old Etonians like Boris Johnson seem light years away. You might as well be governed from the moon. And each year about 55,000 people in Scotland of my age group are dying, and 55,000 young people are becoming eligible to vote. And so the change in opinion about whether Scotland remains part of the UK as it has been for 300 years or goes it alone is going very much in favour of those who want to see it break away from the rest of the United Kingdom.
Okay, now we do have John White joining us from Edinburgh, author and commentator. John White, Nicola Sturgeon says that she hopes for a strong performance by her Scottish National Party in an election in May. That's going to give her the mandate to hold a second referendum. Is doing so within her mandate?
Absolutely, it is within her mandate. The mandate was actually achieved with the Brexit vote, in which 62% of Scots, which translates to every one of Scotland's 32 local authorities, voted to remain. And the idea that we can be ripped out of the EU against our democratic wish and will by a significant majority is anathema to the very principle of democracy. So for me, this prolonged experiment in semi-feudalism at home and colonialism abroad is nearing its end. And high time too. This country is not fit for purpose. 100,000 and counting COVID deaths tells its own grim story in this regard. We have a Tory government that is more akin to a death cult pretending to be a government. It's every utterance at the start of this crisis back in February, March was made with the health of the economy rather than the public in mind. And since then, we have suffered from its criminal negligence. And I think that Scotland's independence is a matter of when, not if.
Well, Derek Conway, former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, seems to think otherwise. He's saying that the Scottish National Party would have a democratic mandate to hold a referendum on Scottish independence, that he did not think that the SNP actually has that mandate. Why is he saying that? And this is, of course, saying he also said that if it wins May's Scottish elections as expected.
Well, politicians, and he's a former Prime Minister, although he's a different political party to me, and I was with him for 25 years in the House of Commons, and we all dance around on pinheads. I think it's ironic your other contributor would want to go away from being a fiefdom of Westminster, being a fiefdom of Brussels. But I think there is a basic point that when in 2014 the Scottish people decided by quite a clear margin to remain within the United Kingdom was then within the European Union. Now that we've left the European Union, I think the moral case for saying the Scottish people are entitled to a say again is quite strong. I mean, at the time, everybody said that 6 years ago that this was a vote for a generation. Well, 6 years is clearly not a generation. But the ground rules have changed because of our withdrawal from the European Union. So I think, although Westminster wants this issue to go away, and Boris Johnson will use every trick in the book to avoid having a referendum on this matter while he's still Prime Minister, I think the fact remains that the mood in Scotland will just grow stronger and stronger. Personally, I think they're wrong. I think it would be a great shame. And I think the next generation Scotland will pay bitterly for those with deep chips on their shoulder who are very happy to take a very large amount of support from the English taxpayer but aren't quite so happy to stay any longer part of the Union. And they'll find the world is very cold outside the UK.
All right. Well, John White, the reports indicate that Prime Minister Boris Johnson is going to be traveling to Scotland to see if he can make it his case. But he's going to be going on very shaky grounds, basically looking at what's happening with the UK. You're talking about coronavirus, talking about an economy that is reported not to go through double-dip recession. What can Boris Johnson say to Nicola Sturgeon to avoid this from happening, as it's called a separation?
Well, for a majority of people in Scotland, Boris Johnson and his ilk is the virus. That is the real virus that is the root cause of all the ill that's facing Scottish society. This is a prime minister, this is a political party that's presided over record levels of poverty, child hunger, homelessness, rough sleeping. They are taking Britain on a rocket ship to hell. These people are lost in the mists of time. They're consumed with British obscurantism. The Brexit is an emotional reach back in time to a supposed golden age when Britannia ruled the waves and the Union Jack flew wherever it damn well pleased. And Derek is wrong. He is the one who's about to find out that the world is a cold place outside the largest free trading bloc in the world. And we're already seeing that. Ask small businesses if Brexit is a good idea, who are suffering the dead weight of added bureaucracy and costs. Ask the fishing industry. Ask hauliers if Brexit is a good idea. Ask the 3 million workers whose employment was dependent on Britain's membership of the single market. This is what happens when theory meets reality. And as I say, there's nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come. And the idea of the breakup of the UK is very much an idea whose time has come. Boris Johnson has got nothing to say to Nicola Sturgeon other than set a date, because it's clear now that the momentum is towards Scottish independence. And if Boris Johnson tries to deny the democratic right of the Scottish people, who are a partner nation in the UK, not a province, as Tories would have us believe, then he is headed for a sticky wicket, because he will then become the greatest friend that Scottish independence could have and the worst enemy that the UK could have.
Well, I'm going to use again Derek Conway. First of all, do you have a response to what our guest John White has, Derek Conway?
Well, I think there's a big assumption in that contribution, which is if Scotland leaves the United Kingdom, it can automatically rejoin the European Union. And I don't think that's a given by any stretch of the imagination, because the balance of the Scottish economy would not fit with the requirements of the European Union as they presently stand. And so it's a question of whether the European Union would want to take on yet another country that would be a taker of resources rather than a giver of resources. And you can bet your bottom dollar that the Spaniards, for example, will have a very strong view on that, because they don't want to give any encouragement to the bits of Spain that would like to break away and be independent. The Catalonia movement will be watching very closely what happens. And so I think Spain would almost certainly use its veto to say to Scotland, well, no, you're not coming back in. You're part of the UK and you've got to make your own way in the world. And then Scotland will find itself an extraordinarily small nation in a big globe. I mean, yes, Britain may have interesting challenges ahead on the Brexit, and we'll have to wait and see. But at the end of the day, it is 67 million people, and that's a big bit of economic clout, whereas Scotland would not be anywhere near in that league. So there are many people in England, actually, wish they could have a vote in the referendum, and there are many people in England who would be saying, well, if that's how you feel, off you go and get on with it. And I think the attitude of Scotland to public expenditure, for example, will come under very, very heavy pressure if they didn't have the weight of the English economy and the City of London, which we all hate and loathe and mock bankers, but at the end of the day, they generate an awful lot of tax revenue. And that's what pays for all the social measures that are friend is arguing for, and I agree with much that he says, but I don't think it's quite as straightforward. This is a decision made on resentment for the past and chips on shoulders about old Etonians. Then it'll be very short judged indeed.
John White, is it true the way that Scotland was just painted by our guest there, Derek Conway?
No, this is what English nationalists would have us believe, that Scotland is not big enough or rich enough or smart enough or resourceful enough to go its own way. This is not about what is easy. This is not going to be easy. Nobody's stupid enough to think so. This is about what is necessary. Scottish independence is now a lifeboat. Derek talks about the tax. The fact is we don't have a just tax system in this country. The rich are not taxed nearly enough compared to their wealth. We have rising levels of inequality. This country is not fit for purpose, as I've said previously. Lack of social and economic justice, food banks, demand spiraling. This pandemic, the way the government's handled it, the fact that we were unprepared to deal with it, this is the fruits of 40 years of Tory party free market ideology. When Margaret Thatcher said infamously that there is no such thing as society, 40 years on, we can see that this was not a statement of fact, it was a statement of intent. And her successors have done their damn best to make that come to pass. That is why we are suffering such grievous mortality, such grievous crisis in the wake of this pandemic. And as I say, it's time for Scotland to go its own way. Scotland is more than capable of going its own way. You don't judge a country by the size of its population or the size of its economy. You judge a country by the size of its idea. And the idea that underpins the majority strain of Scottish independence is social and economic justice.
John's emotion is perfectly reasonable, and I have a considerable amount of sympathy with what he's saying. But at the end of the day, sometimes economics overrules emotion. And like him, you know, let's mock the super rich. I've got no time for them. Why should I? But the fact is that 1% of the richest people in the United Kingdom contribute 26% of the government's income. So it's all right to say to the people, oh, take your richness and your yachts and your big houses and go somewhere else. But when they take that money somewhere else, where does that income come from? And what Scotland would find, of course, is many of its richest people would disappear. And then the government would find itself more than a quarter short of the money it wants to spend on very good and deserving budgets. So a degree of economic reality has to come into it. And that's what happened in 2014. But I think the emotions will be very different when there actually is another referendum, which I reckon would probably be in the next 2 years, and Scotland will then have to find out if it's quite as easy as people are leading them to believe.
So the economic consequences would be great, as our guest there explained, John White, if you agree with him, like his Derek Conway's statement of 1% that contribute to 26% there. I mean, is that the reality?
No, it's not. If the economic consequences of staying in this union are even greater. Call me old-fashioned, I'm an old-fashioned lefty. I would introduce a ban on capital flight. The rich can go wherever they damn well please, but their money stays here, because after all, they made their money in this country. They made their money from the public realm, i.e. the public education system for their workers, the road system, the infrastructure, etc., etc. So they can go wherever they want, but their money will stay here to be invested in...
No, it won't. They tried that. You know, when Harold Wilson was Prime Minister of Britain back in the 60s.
I'm just laying out your division of an independent Scotland that I aspire to. I understand that's not the SNP's vision. I'm not a supporter of the SNP. I'm just giving you my aspiration to show that there is another way. This is not the best of all.
The internet stops all that, John. The internet stops that. When Harold Wilson was Prime Minister, he had controls of taking your money out of the country. But then there weren't computers in those days. Today, when the Scottish referendum is due to be announced at 10 o'clock in the evening, at 10 to 10, anybody with serious sums of money will simply press a button on their computer keyboard and the money will be gone. And it's saying we're going to stop them taking their money, we'll teach them. It won't be there. It'll be long gone. That's what was going to happen when Jeremy Corbyn nearly became Prime Minister. Banks had whole teams of people working for their richest clients who would have had their money out of the country before the 10 o'clock news announced that he'd become Prime Minister. And that's a serious concern if you're trying to balance the books in the Treasury.
Well, this race to the bottomism is part of the problem, isn't it? And it's not just about the tax revenue. That's not the way our government generates money. We have our own central bank. I advocate Scotland to become part of the European Economic Area so that we can have our own central bank and our own currency so that we can print our own money. That is the way ahead. MMT, Modern Monetary theory. We don't have to rely on tax revenue alone. We can print our own money via central bank, and we can use that to invest in public services, in jobs, and in the future. That is the way ahead, as far as I'm concerned. I go back to what I said earlier. This is not the best of all possible worlds, and on the contrary, this is the worst of all possible worlds. There is an alternative, and the Chinese have shown that alternative, which is sustainability, managed capitalism, not in terms of the politics, but in terms of their approach to the economy.
Very well. We've got just a few minutes left. I get a feeling you're not a real fan of former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, Derek Conway, but I have to ask your reaction to what he has said, because it's pretty eye-opening. For example, how he said dissatisfaction is so deep in Scotland that it threatens the end of the United Kingdom. Do you agree?
I think so. I mean, Gordon Brown's a perfectly decent man. I don't think he was a very impressive Prime Minister. He was a much better Chancellor of the Exchequer. So I don't have any quarrel with Gordon Brown as an individual. And I think on this, he's probably quite right. I mean, the trouble is that the SNP in Scotland are very popular. They've pretty well wiped out the Labour Party. The Conservative Party is now the second political party in Scotland. And Nicola Sturgeon, their first minister, seems to be very, very popular with people. And so I think, as in all things, politics is personality. And if I were a Scotsman, I wouldn't like Boris Johnson and his old Etonian accents and his posh friends and all of the things that would make the average Scotsman go, oh, I don't want that running me. The balance of personalities is not good at the moment. So I think the United Kingdom is in some danger. But I think if the United Kingdom were to break up, which would in essence just be Scotland going, I think Wales and Ireland would stay with England, then I think they would still be a very, very strong economic entity and free of the shackles of Brussels, which in Edinburgh they want to wrap themselves around again. I think the contrast would be very startling. Never forget that Venezuela had the fourth richest oil reserves in the world, and look at the state of their economy now. So even with lots of money, politicians can still make a mess of things.
Okay. Last question, I think, is going to go to you, John White. When you take a look at the whole situation concerning the UK, Scotland, and the EU, what do you foresee in order to give us your picture as to what we're looking down in the future here?
Well, when historians come to analyze this period, they will mine a poetic irony, which is that rather than the harbinger of a new golden age, which Brexiteers argued it would be, Brexit is the last brick in the wall of this 19th century colonial theme park. Scottish independence, as I say, is now certain. It's an out about the political struggle to make it happen. Boris Johnson and this rancid Tory establishment will not be minded to issue a Section 30. The last referendum was too close to call, and Boris Johnson, or whoever succeeds him, if he does decide to resign, as some people are saying he's going to do, but if it's Boris Johnson, he will not want his legacy to be dominated by the fact that he is a Prime Minister who, quote-unquote, lost Scotland. The Scottish independence is nigh. It's been a long time coming. The cultural differences, the political differences across the regions and the constituent nations of this state are far too great and far too far-reaching. And the crisis at the heart of the British state is only being accelerated by COVID. So, as I say, Scottish independence will happen. It will not be easy. Nobody should be delusional to think it would be, but it's not about what is easy at this juncture in history. It's about what is absolutely necessary.
Okay, thank you very much for that. That does it for the debate. Let me thank our guest, former MP and presenter Derek Conway. Thank you for your comments. And author and commentator there, John White from Edinburgh. Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the debate. From me, Kavit Takwa, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/EN.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of this series. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's outstanding characteristic, namely, his refraining from being introduced as marja or source of emulation by ulema and his students. Today, we will continue the same topic. Stay tuned. One of the customs in seminaries is that after the demise of a source of emulation, other qualified ulema usually hold the session of ifta, meaning that in a special session they issue fatwa for various subjects. In this way, other clerics and ordinary people understand who is qualified for being the next source of emulation. But Imam Khomeini seriously opposed this custom. Late Ayatollah Ibrahim Amini said, "It was customary among the sources of emulation to hold sessions for answering religious subjects, but Imam Khomeini didn't hold such a session. Naturally, we liked him to hold such a session because it was one of the features of being a source of emulation. However, we were sure that he would not accept. So I told him, some of the jurisprudents who used to attend the classes of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi do not attend other classes, and their studies have halted. If you allow, I will invite them to come to our house a few nights a week to ask jurisprudential issues as that you help them with their problems. Of course, I had meant the session of ifta, but I didn't mention it lest he might not accept." After finishing my words, the Imam looked at me and said, "Mr. Amini, I didn't expect this from you. I expected you to tell me that I am old and my death is close, so I should think of God and the hereafter, and reforming myself and fighting my mean desires. Now you're telling me such words? By the way, what do I need the session of ifta for? If someone asks, I will answer myself." Imam Khomeini maintained that accepting to be a source of emulation would put a heavy responsibility on his shoulder. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Hamid Rouhani says, one of the Iranian ulama came to Najaf after the passing away of Ayatollah Hakim and told the Imam, some of the clerics of Tehran have sent a message to you, meaning saying that your inattention has caused people to refer to others after the demise of Mr. Hakim. They wanted to warn the Imam to do something if he intended to become a source of emulation. But he said, give my regards to them and tell them the more you distance people from us, the more we are comfortable and the lighter our duty and responsibility will be. Another custom in seminaries is that after the demise of a source of emulation, the guardian of the seminary is appointed and announced. In other words, the jurisprudents who accept the guardianship of the seminary will naturally be known as the source of emulation. Although Imam Khomeini was quite qualified for this position, he refrained from being introduced. Hujjatul Islam Mas'udi says, after the passing away of Ayatollah Burujerdi, the top ulama held a meeting and everyone accepted to assume part of the affairs of the seminary. After the meeting, the Imam's son-in-law, Mr. Eshraghi, asked the reason for his refusal, which the Imam answered, nothing. Others are there to handle the affairs of seminary. Mr. Eshraghi was upset and left there. We told the Imam that he had a lot of students who have expectations from him, but he rejected. Mr. Eshraghi said later on that the Imam was very happy and told him, I am happy because the seminary has found a guardian. There are people who will pay the tuition of the seminary, and I am comfortable. Imam Khomeini used to pay tuition to the students in proportionate to the amount of money he had. Once, Mr. Eshraghi asked him to pay part of the tuition of the students through borrowing money. The Imam said, I don't need to put myself in trouble. Mr. Mas'udi, Khomeini also narrates a memory. Once there was a meeting for tuition of seminary students, Imam Khomeini had also attended the meeting. When he came back, we asked him if he had accepted part of the tuition by borrowing money. But he answered, I will never do this. If money comes, I will give the students. Otherwise, there is no need to put myself in trouble. Almighty God is the protector of seminary. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Mohammadi Gilani said, after the demise of Ayatollah Burujerdi, for a while, Imam Khomeini was not content to publish his manual for emulation, although we begged him, saying that our families are his emulators and they need his manual for their religious deeds. The Imam would say, let me be a teacher. Another custom in seminaries is that the sources of emulation send envoys to the Hajj to answer religious questions of the pilgrims. But Imam Khomeini refused to do this. Hujjatul Islam Qarahi says, when the Imam was in Najaf, it was customary among the sources of emulation to send an envoy to the Hajj. Mr. Nasrullah Khalkhali insisted that the Imam should send an envoy, but the Imam refused, as it was a clear act for introduction of sources of emulations.
Good morning.
from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.